companions. We help you discover your many layers. You peel your car, you wake up with fresh eyes. Question life, question humanity, question society, but most of all, question yourself.
Hey Onions Talk listeners, if you're enjoying this podcast, do consider supporting me on Patreon. This work is unfunded, but a lot of work goes into organizing these interviews, editing the audio, and doing communications and publicity. Every bit counts in helping me continue Onions Talk. So do consider supporting on Patreon at FIENEO. You can also find a link in this episode's show notes. Your support will allow me to sustain the work I'm doing. Thank you for tuning in. Enjoy this episode.
Hi, yes, I'm Laura Fisher. I'm an interdisciplinary artist, researcher, and mental health activist. I focus my work on trauma, and specifically on creative approaches to healing and transforming trauma, and to rewriting sociocultural narratives of trauma on survivor's own terms.
So that was quite a lot of stuff, and then sort of like, you know, slowly unpack this, because you and I met in university where it was Central Saint Martin, so very arts based. And how did you sort of like transition from that arts based practice into this sort of larger mental health space, and then really going super in depth into it? And I'm gonna let you explain the rest of your journey, because there's so much in there.
So yes, no, as I realized, there's got a lot in there, and especially the conjunction of arts and sciences. So actually, arts and science were always in my background, in the sense that I always I suppose art took more space, but science was a big interest of mine. I was studying math and physics before going to St. Martin's. But St. Martin's was definitely my aim. I mean, I decided I wanted to study there when I was 12, and I had a little Tupperware box under my bed where I put all my coins, all my money that I could earn to be able to pay for it. So years and years later, I finally managed to go and study there, which is where we met. And I was very happy to be there. And I'm contextualizing the background of it, because it was really important for me to be at CSM. It meant a lot. And art was sort of my way of being. But unfortunately, after all this and all this build-up and excitement when I was there, shortly after I started my course, I experienced some severe traumatic events, and that surfaced a lot of difficulties, so post-traumatic stress disorder and depression, and it raised not only issues related to those events, but also to childhood trauma. And all in all, it meant I became very unwell, and I had to stop my studies. I had to leave university, and that was really hard. I spent I was in this new country. I didn't know the healthcare system. I didn't know what trauma was. I was just trying to survive this whole thing. But eventually I did, and I went back to Central Saint Martins, and I carried on with my studies, but I couldn't just pretend I was a normally functioning human. So I was really interested in sort of understanding what it was to be traumatized, and what that meant on the lived experience level, but also what was happening in my mind, in my brain, in my body. And because I'm someone who wants to understand things, I started doing a lot of research. And I used that material as part of my arts practice, first for my own healing, because arts provided a channel through which I could heal. But then the further I went, the more I researched and the more I explored this, and the more I realized that there was a need for both arts and science in there. And I didn't want anyone else to go through what I had gone through without any understanding of what this horrific thing that is trauma is. So I started opening conversations, and it really built up from there. But after CSM, I wanted to continue exploring through arts, but also bring creative approaches to science and improve the way we understand trauma on a scientific perspective. So then I did postgraduate studies in science and mental health, and now I combine the two.
Wow, incredible. You know, I really admire you. for being so open and honest and vulnerable in your works and finding so much strength out of whatever that you've been through to then be there to support other people. I just thought that was like, that was just such a strong-willed, powerful thing to do. And in the ways that you did it, it was so fearless as well. I mean, you've probably been through so much and probably been through the depths of the darkness, but the way that you managed to emerge out of it all and claim that power and be in a position where you carved it out yourself, you know, no one knew that from our performance design and practice course, someone would go on and do like a PhD research or something in UCL. And you just did all of that research yourself, you know, all of the notes that were in your final degree exhibition. It was just incredible to see in a sort of artistic space where it's least expected, yet everything made sense in your works, what you were exploring. And it was in such a vulnerable and genuine and honest way that was really powerful in an authentic manner. It wasn't just, you know, trying to scream for attention or trying to do something that is loud enough, that is pretty enough so that it gets media attention. It was just, you were true to your heart and you did whatever you were called to do. And along the way, having that sort of journey support you in your own healing process and being in that position where you're like, hey, I'm going to share this with people and hopefully they will not have to go through what I've been through or be able to find some support or solidarity in what I've been through. And then let's wayfind together. And that's, I feel like a lot of socially engaged artists who end up in the work that we do, we kind of start from that perspective where reflecting on our own experiences and pain and not wanting people to have to experience that. And then the sort of care and support that we choose to extend to others. And I just wanted to take a moment to honor that.
Thank you so much. That means a lot because it was not an easy journey. And I just have to say, I am not fearless. it's just that I am afraid, but I do things anyway. So, I do struggle as well, but I think I have managed to turn my experience into insight and turn this insight into action. And really sort of, that's important to me. So I am able to do that and I recognize that and I am grateful for that and I will carry on doing it. But that doesn't mean I don't also struggle as I do. And I do get scared, but I do really genuinely believe that vulnerability is the rawest, most powerful of strengths. And so, I think I fully embrace vulnerability and work with it.
I feel like in a lot of different disciplines, especially sort of in the corporate space, vulnerability can be seen as a weakness. And a lot of times, it is almost used against you to exploit you in whatever ways. But, you know, I'm increasingly feeling like this is why artists are important, because I think by nature of the choice that we make, it's not exactly the most practical or rational or like logical decision if you want to, you know, have a whatever society deems as a comfortable standard of living. But we do that because we pursue our heart and our interest in what we feel we're called to do and what we're passionate about. And with that comes a level of authenticity, which kind of feels like gets quite rare in society at some point, which is a shame, because when we look at the power of communities being able to connect and being able to support each other, a lot of that has to start from vulnerability or rather authenticity. And how many spaces do we have that allow for that to happen? And being able to create safe spaces such that people feel comfortable enough to express, to support, and also to be able to heal together. I guess something that I would be keen to sort of explore a little bit more with you is So the artistic and creative process and healing, and then intersecting with the science of it. So for me, it was interesting to hear what you said, because I found resonance in my own journey as well, where I think during the 4 years that I was at Central Saint Martins, a lot of times the work that I was doing also allowed me a window and a door, I guess, that opens and allows me to explore some of the past experiences or issues that I had, and to actually be able to reflect on those life experiences and really open up what was the pain and the hurt that needed to be healed, needed to be unlocked. So could you sort of like share a little bit of how that healing process would look like, I guess, from your perspective as a practitioner in the art space, but also in the mental health space, and also blending in the science of it?
So that's quite a lot, isn't it?
Yeah.
First of all, I agree that as artists, we have access to a breadth of ways of exploring things, of articulating things, of expressing, and that's really rich. So creative channels are so powerful for healing. But I do want to stress that even people who are not artists still have access to creativity and still have access to healing via creative channels. And that's where my work sort of lies. So a key part of my work is on developing a trauma-focused movement language, which is essentially a creative embodied process of co-creating healing. So it reframes a lot of the dynamics, the traditional dynamics of how we approach healing or clinical treatments, because essentially the current therapy scene is not super great for trauma. So there are some great therapists and there are some good approaches, but generally speaking, most of them approach trauma as an experience that can be talked about. So most therapies are talk-based, but trauma is actually not located in a rational linguistic space. It's embodied, it's visceral, it's really integral to how you behave, how you feel, and it's much more than just words. And in fact, you can't really, and I won't go into the whole neurobiology of trauma, but you can't really talk about trauma like you can talk about any other memories. So talking is going to help in the sense of validation, understanding, so essentially cognitive and some emotional level, but it's not going to resolve it. You can't think yourself, you can't talk yourself through healing, you have to experience it. And creative approaches allow you to have that experience. So that's what I'm developing, is this intervention that is creative and body-based, where you can experience healing, where you can co-create healing. So again, another reframing of traditional approaches is that it's not a hierarchical space. It's not a space where a clinician comes in with a solution and the broken trauma survivor comes in and is being repaired by that. So it's not, it doesn't work in that way. I believe trauma survivors have immense power and resources and are able to transform their experiences and heal and grow from trauma. You can't return to who you were before, because that's not how it works, but you can transform it so that trauma doesn't define you and you define it, and you live through and despite and beyond trauma. So my work is using all these dynamics, and it's accessible to anyone who has a mind and a body. So you don't need to be a dancer, you don't need to be creative, you don't need any specific ability. Essentially, it's for everyone, but it's a creative approach, it's a non-hierarchical space, it's a survivor-led space, it's a way of working that recognizes essentially two main things. One, the neurobiology of trauma, which is common to all survivors, and the lived experience of trauma, which is unique to each survivor. And we work with a structure that enables the process to be tailored to each and to be creative and connected and in a way that we can build a new relationship with ourselves and with others.
Wow, thank you for sharing. There's so much that I don't know about trauma yet. And could you sort of give some examples of how that process would look like? Especially, I guess, you know, how, for example, a typical therapy session or one of the sessions that you would have with a client or a group, how would that sort of pan out?
So I'm still developing this practice. So this is something that was born out of my experience, and that was one of my final projects for at Central St. Martins. But I was very mindful that my experience was really important in informing that, but wasn't going to be the only thing that should shape this practice. So I've been looking at it through many angles, first through an arts-based approach. Then I got a fellowship at the National Institute for Health Research to explore the clinical applications of this. Then I explored it through scientific research and was evaluated with different things. And it's so still in development, but I do, by popular demand, I do offer workshops. And so there are three main components to this work and to what it would look like in practice. So one is the theory. Survivors want to know what trauma is, you know, what's happening. It's important to understand your experience. And unfortunately, in our culture right now, it's getting a little bit better, but we still don't have an awareness of trauma, an understanding of what trauma is, how to recognize it, how it manifests, how to deal with it. And so there's a part about just understanding that, understanding the neurobiology of trauma. So I explain that, and we, you know, so there's that part of, I suppose, education. And then the key part is the practice. And the practice is about essentially rebuilding a connection to the body, because there's a tension but or an opportunity at the same time in that trauma is held in the body, and the body simultaneously holds the keys to healing. So via an embodied approach and connection to the body, you can use body to brain connections to heal and change the brain. So really measurably so, you can see a change in the brain, because we tend to always know about the brain to body connections, but people don't tend to think about the body to brain connections. And in fact, the body has a bigger influence on the brain than the brain has on the body. So we work with the body, but the tension and opportunity I was mentioning is that it's held in the body, but therefore that's not where you want to go. Trauma's held there. So most survivors want to avoid being in their bodies for natural, clear reasons. You know, it's understandable. That's where the horror and the pain is. You don't want to go with that. But that's where you need to go if you want to transform that and experience healing. So so that's what the practice is about. It's about reconnecting to the body, rebuilding a relationship to the body, and then building a relationship from body to mind, back to mind, back to brain, and via techniques that allow this reshifting. So there's parts of the brain that are deactivated because of trauma, parts of the brain that are hyperactive. And through creative body-based approaches, you can realign that and repattern it. So you can essentially process traumatic memories and rebuild a sense of safety. And safety, there are three types of safety. And through the practice, we target all three. So physical safety, which means being safe from harm, and internal safety, so feeling safe in yourself, and relational safety, so feeling safe with others. And that's the practice. And then the final element is reflection. So we do have an element of sharing reflections and sharing the process.
If someone's experience of a traumatic incident or a period of time is not something that was physical, say verbal abuse, would that still be stored in the body?
Yeah, that's a good question. So there are So I speak of trauma as an umbrella term, because actually there are different types of traumatic experiences, right? And they can occur as a single event. They can occur as a prolonged a period of time that is traumatic. They can be a repeated series of events, and they can be in childhood, or they can be in adulthood, or they can be in both. And all of those things will have slightly different implications. And also they can be, these experiences by nature can be emotional abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, but they can also be witnessing difficult events. They can be witnessing domestic violence, for example, and they can also be something that isn't abuse, that is something that we may not experience as traumatic, but someone else might. So there's not an exhaustive list of what qualifies as traumatic or not, because it's really subjective. But within all these differences, the impact on the person, so the traumatic experiences are varied, but the trauma, which is the impact of the experiences, is actually quite common to all. So if you look at it from a neurobiology standpoint, and you look at what happens in the brain and the body and the psychophysiology, you see that it's pretty much the same. So whether you experience verbal abuse or physical abuse, it still will be stored in the body. And it doesn't mean it's not in the mind, it is, but it's more strongly held in the body. So it's essentially the four types of memory. We have four types of memory: two that are conscious, two that are unconscious. And the unconscious ones are held in the body as sensations and physical manifestations. And trauma, again, it would take too long to go into the whole neurobiology and mechanisms, but essentially you can't process traumatic memories like you do normal memories. And that's what characterizes the fact that they're held in the body. So it's not the nature of the experience, it's the nature of trauma and how actually that impacts the body and how that impacts the person as a whole. So yes, whether that's verbal abuse or physical abuse, as the moment that an experience, no matter what it is experienced as traumatic, it will be held in the body in procedural and emotional memory, and obviously with connections to the conscious mind as well. But there's a disruptions and a rejigging of your entire organism. So yes, that's the answer.
Thank you for sharing that about that. I'd like to sort of like move us out of this scientific space to kind of have a more, I guess, macro perspective on your life experiences and this sort of transition. So from the art space and then doing all sort of going back into the sciences and carving your own career in the science, but positioning yourself as an artistic creative practitioner, how has that process been for you? Were there certain things that you struggled with or that people saw you differently because of the sort of I guess nature of your background and experiences? How was that journey like?
Well, it's been a very interesting journey. I didn't get bored at any point in time, for sure. I never fitted in any box. I don't like boxes. I don't like silos. I don't like labels. So I always had this tension between arts and science, and essentially never saw the point of separating them. So I see the differences, but I see the commonalities even more. And especially I see the gray zone in between, and those blurry borders in between is the place where I've located myself always. So I've always struggled with that tension even before this current work. And when I was exhibiting my art, I was seen as an artist. When I was working as an external examiner in math and physics, I was seen as a scientist, and so on. And I didn't like that. I didn't understand why we had to be labeled by one or the other. So that tension has just basically carried on. So now that I'm working in trauma, when I'm in scientific spaces, I keep pushing for the creative thinking. When I'm in creative spaces, I keep pushing for other approaches to bring to be brought through, such as science, neuroscience in this case. So I've basically just continued, and sometimes that comes with friction because people don't get it. Sometimes that comes with just a lot of dancing around and bringing those things together. And I suppose it doesn't matter so much that not everybody gets it, because those who do get it are the people that I will connect to and work with. So it does, and it's not about thinking in the same way, but just seeing that value. So I suppose my approach is that I just am very, very, have very strong values, and I stay very close to them, so that natural connections are made, whether we connect on those values or not. But yeah, sometimes it's confusing. Sometimes I wish I just did one thing and that was it. And sometimes, I mean, most of the time, I just recognized I could never be, I'm just made to do multiple things.
Well, I'm also asking this question because I'm trying to put it out there that to not have that fear of breaking those boundaries or boxes, even if society doesn't understand you for doing so, and that going and venturing into different spaces, people look at you differently, or you don't feel like you fit in because your experiences are different. And I'm trying to just put it out there that there are a lot of opportunities that can also be created in those sort of interdisciplinary spaces. Would you be able to sort of share like how you managed to get opportunities along the way? Did you meet sort of supporters who really understood what you were doing or supported what you were doing and wanted to create more spaces for the kind of intersectional work that you were creating and could offer to the world?
Yes, I can say a little bit. Of course, it will just be my experience, but I do want to emphasize what you said about creating opportunities and creating paths, because I've never felt ever that there was a path that was right for me, even before I focused on trauma. So I really, really believe that you can just create your path, and we need more people that create paths, because the current paths are not good enough. So we really need to tread our own paths, and then we can meet on these new paths, and new paths can be created. So the way I've done that is, obviously, as I said, it was very clear to me that there was no right path for me, so that my only option was to create one. And to do that, well, there's two challenges, isn't there? There's the belief in yourself, and there's other people believing in you. And the way I've worked around sometimes the lack of belief in myself, because as in everyone, I guess it oscillates, it goes up and down, is that I've believed so much in the work. So for trauma especially, I believed so much in the need to have those conversations, to have this rethinking, these new approaches, that bypassed the fact that I sometimes lacked belief in myself. And then belief in others. I think if you're strong and clear about what you believe in and why you believe in it, people will see that, and will, those who connect will be able to support that. So I started completely alone. So after I left CSM and was struggling with trauma, there was almost nobody that was there for me, because people didn't understand what's going on, and a lot of people just don't want much to do with complex, difficult things. So when I came back and started to work on trauma, it felt like I was all alone on this huge stage that is the world, and trying to shout, we need to think about trauma, we need to talk about trauma. And I was all alone. But by doing that, I knew I was doing that for a reason. And it was a shift from how I usually did things, because up until then, I didn't really like to put myself out there. I had been exhibiting my artwork since I was 12, but I had never told my friends or anyone I knew about it. So I would just hide the posters, not tell anyone about it, not try and keep it just for me, this. So, but share it only with strangers, which was a bit paradoxical. Anyway, I realized when working on trauma, I couldn't do that. I wasn't going to have any impact to change anything on how we work with trauma if I was staying in my cave. So I came out and really tried to build that. I mean, the very first piece of work that I did on trauma was a film, a short film called Silence is Screaming. I was not yet able to use words and to talk about trauma, but it was my first articulation of it. And then it moved to much more clear ways of talking about trauma. But it's that belief, it's that conviction that I knew why I was doing what I was doing, and I believed in its importance. And that's what I think allowed me to just create opportunities where there were none and knock doors down, because no one was going to do it for me. So I started doing it by myself in every way I could, seizing all the opportunities I could. And then gradually a movement was built, people that connected to it, whether that was survivors, researchers, practitioners, artists, whoever, the momentum started to build, and then it became a bit easier. Then people connected, and we sort of, via people who had similar values, we then knocked doors down together and built from there. So essentially, I would say, I don't know how useful this is, but I would say, starting by the belief in the work and just going for it no matter why and how, and just putting that forward, and then little by little it will get easier because people will connect to that and help in that momentum.
So like from the sort of organization where you're finally getting to the right people, how did that transform into action where, you know, a concrete project or something was born out of those connections?
As projects have taken many forms and were born in many different ways. Again, at first they were just my projects, doing them by myself. Then luckily, well, not luckily, but by working on this, I was fortunately able to connect, and then these new projects were formed in different ways. But I would say, mostly at first, just from, you know, our time and effort and what was available to us. So that means no funding or no resources and so on. But gradually, I was able to find resources, and still now it's a combination. Some projects have lots of resources, some have none at all. But as much as I'm able, I will do things, and no matter what the resource is, if it's something that is important to do. And finding those, so some people, not everybody works like that. Obviously, some people only work with when a grant has been awarded, or, you know, it's different ways of working. But so I guess I can't really answer this question very easily, because it's looked so many ways. It's looked different every time.
How did your work sort of get to a point where it's financially sustainable itself? Where were the sort of financial income streams or funding coming from?
Well, I've been self-employed for so long. So for me, for it to be secure, I don't know if I could say I've ever been fully secure, because there's times where there's income and it's fine, and there's times where I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm very resourceful, so I always find a way. But sometimes it's really scraping by, and sometimes it's really comfortable. So although now I have more times of being comfortable than times of scraping, and then before I had more times of scraping than being comfortable, so I suppose it's not fully secure in that there's still times where I think, how am I going to pay rent and so on? But I do feel it's in the right direction, which I suppose is what matters right now.
Do you feel like you are getting to a point where it's more comfortable more of the times when your social capital has increased?
Yeah, I think it's, you're right. I think there's a correlation. Yeah, between social capital. I never thought about it like that, but you're right. Yeah, it's very interesting to realize there is the network has built, the momentum has built, and the income has built.
I think we've found everything that it's about sort of movement building, where it's about trying to bring a value to the world that perhaps the world hasn't quite seen yet what this value is, or recognize what that is. When you are someone who is, you know, the first in line, paving a path that hasn't been paved before, or doing something that is different and new, it's always going to be really difficult. And I just sort of want to point that out, that this is a journey that sort of slowly builds up. So we were talking about belief, right? Like the belief that comes within yourself, the belief that you have that you will be able to, that you are capable, that you will be able to do what you set out to do. And then there's the belief that is given from other people around who believe in the work that you do. And I think a lot of times, perhaps, you know, when you're figuring things out and you don't have a standard for comparison, you don't have an example, you don't have someone to go like, this is how things should look, then, you know, it, that sort of lack of confidence or belief of oneself can kick in. But, you know, having that sort of confidence in yourself, building it, and really just putting that faith in yourself and the work that you're doing is so important, because when you have that confidence, it shows to everyone else. And it's also, I think, law of attraction, where if you believe that you deserve something, and if you believe that you deserve better, you will be able to get that. And when the sort of like all the conditions are in place in very miraculous and magical ways that you don't see, with invisible hands, the right people sort of come into your life. I'm kind of saying this because it took me a long time to sort of get to that point of conviction, because I've been doing a lot of things, and because I've been in so many different spaces and sectors, and people just don't quite understand what am I doing? Who am I? Like, why is it that I'm doing so many different things? And a lot of times people just go, oh, wow, that's a very cool sort of like life journey experience that you've got. But then I'm constantly, you know, thinking, am I going down the right path? Even though I believe that there is value, there is a lot of value in the work that I am doing, that I'm trying to bring in this to this world. But it's just, it's a very difficult process of getting the right resources or funding to do something that perhaps, you know, the system doesn't really want you to do, because it's questioning a lot of these power relations. And in these kind of situations, it can feel like, wait, should this be this tough? Like, how much longer do I allow myself to struggle before I have to let it go or give up? But then something else that revealed along the way was this realization that once you have that conviction, that belief, that confidence, once you start connecting with other people who are like-minded, who share your energy, your vision, or are sort of pursuing the same or similar veins of purpose, then when you slowly band together at the right moment, the resources will come. And having conviction that this is going to help you, and that no matter what, even if, you know, all these networking sometimes can feel like, I don't know where I'm going with this, I'm having a lot of conversations and it just kind of feels like, you know, the action, it's not there, and we are still having a lot of these conversations but not making it into something that's physical or concrete. It's, you know, all of that networking, it's also a building of social capital, which I think there are research out there that shows that the larger your social capital is, the more that you build and work on it, the higher your chances of being successful in life. And I think it boils down to the sort of community and support in our network support system. When you build connections with people who genuinely care about you and the work that you do, not in a very superficial, like professional networking sort of events sort of way, but genuinely connecting on someone based on their values, based on what they want to give to the world, based on what they want to contribute, based on the topics that you want to uncover or investigate or open up, the sort of conversations towards I guess a better sort of social environmental state, these sort of conversations, these sort of connections, eventually it will form a movement, and it's really like your person-to-person relationship fundamentally. And don't ever feel like you are alone. If you're constantly working and building these networks in a genuine and authentic way, the resources will come at some point, and have faith, have that faith and confidence.
I agree completely.
And how, sort of like looking back on the past couple of years and what you've been through, what were some of the key learning points in your life?
Oh, wow. That's a big question.
Have you had a chance to reflect back?
I have. I generally am someone who does a lot of reflection, but I haven't sort of distilled it into my key learnings. But from the top of my head, what I could share is vulnerability is a superpower. Trauma survivors are immensely powerful and resourceful. Protecting people from violence and abuse, and supporting people to survive and live past trauma, is everyone's responsibility. And it's also everyone's responsibility to rewrite our sociocultural narrative. And we can all challenge the status quo and demand and create better.
What are some of your thoughts on recent sort of social political events and the sort of larger collective trauma, or I guess reawakening of these triggers, I guess emotional triggers, that these sort of incidents would have brought about to certain individuals?
Another big question.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is a whole other topic, actually. It's difficult because there are multi-layers of trauma, and we have historic trauma, we have intergenerational trauma, which is related but a little bit different, because there's this cultural heritage of trauma, such as racism is a historic cultural collective trauma. And then there are all the individual narratives, and they're connectors, of course. All trauma is connected within yourself, and what you inherit and all your experiences are connected. They're not neat little boxes. So when something happens in such as recently the in the news, sexual violence was very present, racism has been very present, and both of these things, rightly so, we need these things to be present. But when they come because of events, horrific events that happen, and when they trigger all this political, social movement and response, these are necessary, right? Because that we need to change this cultural narrative and our history. But when they happen, as much as they are needed and right, they are really difficult. Because those, talking about trauma survivors, and I include survivors of racism and sexism in this instance, you want to be part of that movement. You want to respond, learn, build, improve. You want to take action, but you have to negotiate your own well-being and the well-being that you're building. So we are building a better future for others, but we also have to think of the present time of ourselves and people around us. And that's really hard. When you think about people experiencing racism, there's such a weight, such a heritage of systemic oppression, of violence, invisible violence and visible violence, that demanding that these are the same people who fight for racism to be destroyed is such an immense ask, and we cannot do that. We all need to be part of it. We need allyship. And it's the same thing for sexism, and it's the same thing for other forms of trauma. But there's particularly big weight for racism because of the history. And it's how do we support people who experience it now, as well as how do we build a better future? And how do we untangle the systemic, historical, cultural racism, the historic cultural trauma, to the individual narratives of trauma, and how did he intersect, and how did he intersect with other forms of trauma? So it's important to consider that complexity, and I suppose we can't go into that whole complexity today, but I think it's important to embrace complexity rather than run away from it, and also to understand, that's what I was saying before, it's everyone's responsibility, because this is the world that we share. We're all responsible for it. And it's not those who are at the receiving end of something that should be the ones fighting for it on their own.
What are the things that people can do to make a difference, positive difference?
Well, there's a lot, but if I speak of like trauma specifically, which does encompass all the different types, first of all, is to be informed. What is trauma? What is abuse, violence, oppression? What are these things? How do they affect people? How do you recognize this effect, this impact? How do you see whether, how do you notice the signs of potentially someone being abused, being at the receiving end of racism, being, you know, experiencing any one of those experiences? So first it's about education in that sense, but then it's about action. So it's being proactive. It's making sure you do not close your eyes. And that's worth saying, because none of us want this stuff to happen. Well, at least most of us don't want this stuff to happen. But a lot of people, just their way of dealing with it is too hard, it's too difficult, I'm just going to look away. And we just cannot do that. We must keep our eyes open, our ears open, our hearts open, so that we can notice and then act upon what we notice. And if you don't know exactly what to do, don't do nothing. Ask the person what you can do. If you notice someone might be experiencing abuse, go to them and try and build, if you have time for this someone you know, try to build a safe space and build a relationship of trust to allow them to disclose or share or reach out to you if needed. Make yourself available. If this is something that you don't have, you know, this is someone you don't know and you just come across it, just come directly to the person and ask if you can help, if there's anything you can help with. Be gentle and supportive. Be proactive, but don't take leadership. So the person experiencing the difficulty will always have to remain the leader, in the sense that they need to control the choices of what happens, but you can support and facilitate that.
I think in situations in which someone might not be able to relate or understand somebody else's pain or experiences, there is a tendency to want to give advice. Do you think it's advisable to give advice in these situations?
Unless you really, really, really know what you're talking about. And even then, it might not always be appropriate. I think the best thing to do is just listen. We are deprived from people who actually take the time to listen. So especially when someone is struggling, the first most important thing they need is to be heard. So make yourself available, be present, offer non-judgmental, supportive listening. If they want advice, they will ask you. And if you feel like you do have very important advice to offer, you can ask whether you can offer it. You can say, may I suggest something based on my experience or based on my knowledge? And then they'll say yes or no. And they will, or even if you do share it and you haven't asked because you think it's urgent and imperative to share it, don't worry about their response, because they'll take it in their own time when they're ready.
Thank you for sharing that. That was so important. If there is one thing that someone could do to create change in this world, what would it be?
Well, actually, I think you could start by listening. And something I like to sort of live by is, I always assume I don't know. Because the more you know, the more you know you don't know. And yes, I know a lot of stuff, but in the great scheme of things, I know very little. And if I assume I don't know, I will always learn. And if I'm able to listen and learn, then I can have much more meaningful actions.
I'm going to end this off with, on a lighter note, what is one dish with onions that you love?
A dish with onions?
Yeah. We've done the talking. Now we're just going to hide the onions part, and then we can end off onions talk.
I hope we can have that meal too afterwards. one day. I think onions are important culinary items for a lot of things. I do like noodles with fried onions on top.
That's great. Where can people find out more about your work?
So on my website, which is Laura Fisher, actually, if people just Google Laura Fisher trauma, it comes up. Otherwise, on Instagram, which is Brains and Brushes, my handle.
Thank you for sharing with us and giving your time for this.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
No problem.
Peel the layers and be the change. Onions Talk podcast keeps you going when times are tough, and a crystallized learning that you can apply on your impact work to save you unnecessary struggles. Change-making work is tough. Sometimes it feels like all the odds are against you, and it's a constant upward battle. My name is Fia, and I'm here to support you. If you're not yet on this journey, give Onions Talk a listen. Be inspired, be touched, be motivated. I also run purpose discovery workshops online. Follow me on LinkedIn or Instagram at FEEYEH_NEO for updates, workshops, and future events. I also run a network called INSEP, International Network for Socially Engaged Practitioners, and we are always looking for partners and funders to continue cross-sector conversations and facilitate collaborations towards systems change. Check out my website at fieneo.art and get in touch if you'd like to work together. If you like this episode and would love to support, subscribe, leave a rating, write a review on iTunes, and consider donating. Your gift will allow me to continue supporting changemakers in a more sustainable way. Onions Talk is on Spotify, Google Podcasts, iTunes, and most other podcasting sites. If it's not there, send me an email at heyonionstalk@gmail.com. Special thanks to Andrea for the music. Catch you next episode.